Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each day we bring you a passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength, insight, and wisdom in everyday life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us, dailystoic.com. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
I was out in front of the painted porch the other day with some of my employees. We were talking about something, and I could hear this sort of commotion inside the store, and this man was like yelling at Jessica, who works for Daily Stoic and the painted porch, and just being a real jerk. I could sort of see, I was like, oh great, this is someone yelling about the mask policy in the store. And I was like, sir, come on, if you don't want to wear it, you don't have to shop here, just come on. And he storms out and he sort of confronts me. And I think I did a pretty good job controlling my temper. You know, he was, blah, 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 how could you do this? He's yelling. And he said, this is so stupid. And I said, you're right, sir. It's very stupid. I thought that was funny. And then he's, continuing to yell at me. And I just said, man, you just don't have to shop here. It's not a big deal. You just, if it bothers you, you don't have to shop here. And he's going on about some, you know, insane pseudoscience and how the pandemic isn't real. And I said, it's all right, dude. You clearly don't read books. Just move along, which probably wasn't the nicest thing. I don't pretend to be a perfect stoic. There's that Jeff Bezos line that it's easier to be clever than kind. And I was certainly more clever in that situation than kind. But what I really dislike is, like, you can believe whatever you want, but don't come in and yell at some employee who it's not their decision. They have a hard job. They shouldn't have to put up with your crap. And least of all in these strange, surreal times, least of all over a safety protocol. So I have a problem with bullies. And this was a very clear example of bullying plus a temper tantrum thrown by a very old man who should have known a lot better. The point is, all of this is to set up today's interview with one of my favorite people, a very sweet man, a very great writer who would never do such a thing. And we talk about this in the interview, talk about Marcus Aurelius, talk about Seneca, how they would have struggled to put these ideas into practice. It's easy to know, hey, you know, be kind, be courteous, let it roll off your back like water in a duck. But it's hard to do it in practice, right? It's hard to do it in practice. And Donald Robertson's amazing book, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. It's actually a book that would have been 10 feet from me inside the store. One of the great books on Stoic philosophy published in the last couple of years, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, The Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius. He also has a new graphic novel called Verissimus, The Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius. And he is a cognitive behavioral psychotherapist and trainer. He was born in Scotland, worked as a psychotherapist in London for 20 years, then he immigrated to Canada, and now he divides his time between Greece and Canada. We both had the same book agent in Stephen Hanselman. He's a great public speaker, has a delightful accent, And I was excited to have him on the podcast for the second time to bring this full circle. It felt like I just had him on the podcast. And then it struck me that I'd interviewed him from the closet in my wife's parents' house when we visited them in Los Angeles in the depths of the pandemic in July 2020. So 2 years went by just like that. And yet here we are arguing over the same things, not just that we were 2 years ago, but arguing over the same things that Marcus Aurelius was experiencing and shaking his head at and being frustrated with in his own time, just as we were 100 years ago, as John M. Barry, my guest from a couple weeks ago, talks about in The Great Influenza, all of which is a beautiful, tragic, funny, sad, frustrating illustration of that very stoic concept of how history is the same thing happening over and over and over and over again. That's just how it is. Got to come to terms with it. Check out How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. You can pick that up in The Painted Porch or anywhere books are sold. Check out Donald Robertson's new graphic novel, Verismus. And you can check out his work at donaldrobertson.name or follow him on Twitter at Don J. Robertson. Well, I was thinking we should start because I know you did this new book partly for your daughter. And thinking about how the value of Stoicism when you're young is really interesting to me because the more I think about Marcus Aurelius's childhood, the more fascinated I am by it. I was thinking about this the other day. So if you lay out Marcus Aurelius's childhood and Nero's childhood side by side, they're actually very similar, right? They both lose their father very young. They're not actually in line for the throne. And they're introduced to Stoicism more or less in their in their sort of late teens by a great Stoic teacher, Rusticus for Marcus, Seneca for Nero. They both become emperor, and yet it goes very differently for each one.
Yeah, that's right. Do you know, honestly, I've never even thought about that before, but you're absolutely right. And why is that? Gosh, I don't, you know, well, controversial, like maybe Seneca isn't, like, wasn't as good a role model in some ways as Junius Rusticus, perhaps, you know, like that, it has to be said, you know, maybe Seneca, you know, wasn't as, didn't stick to Stoic principles as much as someone else might have. I see, you know, we can't know for sure, but I think Seneca kind of collaborated with Nero to some extent. And certainly I don't think Seneca was very popular with the Stoic opposition. I think they saw him like as a bit of a traitor, perhaps. So that could be part of it. Also, what's interesting is Marcus mentions Nero and, you know, he kind of uses him as an example of a degenerate and a tyrant, basically. And also another weird bit of trivia for you is that Lucius Verus, if I remember rightly, had the same birthday as Nero. Like, and so people, that what that tells us is that Romans would inevitably have thought that there was some kind of comparison between them. The historians think it's worth mentioning that, you know, but they didn't think he was as bad as Nero. But they were both kind of wanted to be celebrities in a way. They were kind of preoccupied with their appearance.
Well, I think one potential difference long before Seneca is the mother. Marcus writes quite beautifully about his mother at the beginning of Meditations. Here, actually, let me grab it because it might be, people might like it. He says some very beautiful things about his mother. We should riff on this. Here, let me grab it. This is Gregory Hayes. He says, "My mother, her reverence for the divine, her generosity, her inability not only to do wrong but to even conceive of doing it, and the simple way she lived, not in the least like the rich." I don't think Nero would have written that about his mother.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe not in the least like Agrippina. You know, perhaps, like, she was, Marcus's mother was an interesting, I wish we knew more about her, but from the little that we know, she seems to have had a big influence on him, and she seems to have been a a really interesting woman. She grew up in the same household as Herodes Atticus, who is the preeminent sophist of the period, which is kind of intriguing because she was obviously, to some extent, a Hellenophile. Like she wrote in Greek and must have been pretty well acquainted with Greek literature and was and knew, although actually we don't know whether she really got on with Herodes Atticus, like, because a lot of people found him quite a dislikable guy. But there's a weird connection. The more you study Marcus's life, the more interesting the meditation becomes, because, you know, that suddenly this all the scenery starts appearing around him, you know, and this constellation of people that you know, allows to read more between the lines in the meditations.
Yeah, I heard a historian once say about George Washington that the more you study the man, the more you like him. Mm-hmm. Or the more impressive he turns out to be. And I think that holds true for Marcus Aurelius. It's been rare that I've ever discovered something about Marcus that I didn't know. And I learned a lot from your first book, for instance. But I've been reading Henry Sedgwick wrote this little biography of Marcus Aurelius that I'm reading right now, sort of lost or forgotten biography. Every time I read a new perspective on Marcus, I end up respecting or admiring him more. There really hasn't been anything that I've come away with and gone, ugh, that was disappointing. Whereas Seneca is kind of the opposite. The more you study Seneca, the more complicated it
is. The more you study Seneca, the more you dig into Seneca, like the more problematic like he becomes. Seneca, I guess this is a question of terminology. Normally when we say sophist and we're talking about classical antiquity, we're really talking about Greek thinkers. But there were Latin orators and rhetoricians that are very similar to sophists. And so you can kind of talk about Latin sophists. So Fronto, for example, is a bit like a sophist. He's kind of a Latin sophist. Seneca is borderline Latin sophist, like, in a sense. It's not really clear to what extent he actually lived. And also because we can't see him, right?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you would know a philosopher if you walked past one in the street, or you kind of knew them personally. It was obvious that they were really living like a philosopher. But I think with Seneca, people probably got the opposite impression. You know, he had those hundreds of mahogany tables or whatever it was, and, you know, these huge estates and things. And, you know, he was always hobnobbing with society and stuff. So I think the people that were around him probably thought, like, you know, there's a big gap between what you portray in your writings and what your life is actually like. And I really think Seneca... One of the things I take from his writings is that even if I try and sort of suspend judgment about what sort of person he was, like, it seems to me he's putting quite a lot of effort in his writings into constructing his public image.
Sure.
And he doesn't really say much about his, like in the letters to Lucilius, for example, and his other writings, you know, you wouldn't really imagine that he was Nero's right-hand man. Like, he doesn't talk about that, and he doesn't really give any hints about his opulent wealth. Like, there's a lot of stuff that he leaves out in order to construct a kind of different image of himself.
Well, so for people who are listening who are not as familiar with the terms, is that kind of how you would distinguish between a sophist and a stoic, or a sophist and a philosopher? Sort of one is interested in theory and ideas and beautiful language, and the other is about sort of the code of ethics and practices?
And this is a really cool question, right? Like, how do you spot a sophist is like a really good question, because Socrates says in one of the Platonic dialogues, you guys sound just like philosophers sometimes. I think it's in the Euthydemus, he says something like that. And Epictetus, if I remember rightly, there's a passage where Epictetus says something along those lines as well. So sometimes a sophist could look just like a philosopher. For instance, Herodes Atticus used to quote Epictetus to people. Like, so he was really good at quoting Epictetus, apparently. Like, he knew the discourses really well. So he would sound like a sophist. But was he doing it because he really agreed with Epictetus, or because he thought it was impressive? Like, and it was all show. Like, it would get a round of applause. It made him look intelligent. Like, the sophists used to compete giving speeches, kind of like on social media today. You know, the most popular post gets the most engagement and most likes. This office would compete to get the biggest round of applause from their audience or to draw the biggest crowd. So they saw what they were doing as kind of like a game, a competition. It was all about appearances. It was all about image over substance, if you like. And I think that's really the difference. And one of the differences that Socrates would have said as well is, you know, there's an aspect of Socratic irony that people don't mention that much. But it's mentioned several times in Plato that Socrates used to pretend he had a bad memory, which is kind of weird, right? He'd be like, oh, listen, I've just got this terrible memory. People like, Socrates, we know you don't have a bad memory. And the reason, supposedly, that he did it was that he didn't like the fact that sophists would talk for a long time without interruption. And he thought he needed to keep stopping them and just say, hang on a minute, that thing that you just said, or that assumption that you just made, can we just go back a couple of steps and question that? Like, because if you, I'm going to lose track if you keep going. Like, just let's just stop every couple of minutes. And they hated that because they kind of interrupted their flow. But, you know, it's really easy for someone to make an assumption that's false and then talk for an hour about it and blind you with, you know, rhetoric. And that's kind of what he wanted to prevent them from doing. So sophists would talk a lot without necessarily allowing people to question the presuppositions that they were making.
So that's something I imagine you can relate to. I certainly can too. I can explain a piece of Stoic philosophy. I can get it perfectly done on the page. I can do it in an interview like this. I could do it on social media. I even can know what will the audience will respond to most, what will resonate the most, what people need to hear the most. But there is, of course, the very big difference between then applying that in your personal life, not because you don't agree with it or don't care about it, but because it's extraordinarily hard, right? So there's like multiple levels of hypocrisy, right? There could be the hypocrisy of like, hey, you shouldn't have premarital sex or sex outside of marriage. Meanwhile, you're carrying on and having affairs. You're saying something that you just don't believe. You're trying to hold you're holding people to a standard for, you know, Christianity reasons or personal reasons or whatever, which you don't believe. That's a level of hypocrisy, which maybe Seneca is at, maybe he's not. And then there's this sort of other level, which is, you know, maybe Marcus Aurelius is talking in Meditations about, you know, life is too short to care about this or that, or this is why you can't lose your temper at so-and-so. And then life is hard, right? Then actually doing it is hard, even if you agree with it and can repeat it back perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, I mean, I think we're kind of getting to the core of what the difference was between like these two characters, Nero, Marcus Aurelius. It's partly the people that were around them, I think, made a difference. Sure. And maybe also their personality traits. But I think that the Marcus didn't want to be famous, as far as we can tell. Like, I think also Marcus saw Hadrian in decline. And what I take away from reading the Roman histories that maybe isn't always emphasized is I really think Hadrian had a big impact on Marcus. And it was a car crash. And Marcus saw Hadrian kind of going crazy. I kind of imagine Hadrian a bit like, you know, Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now or something like that. He built this huge estate, like, outside of Rome and kind of holed himself up there. Like, he completely fell out with the Senate and was having these political purges and going crazy. And so Marcus saw, like, this collapse basically happening. Hadrian actually brought Marcus to come and live with him for like the last 6 months or so of his life. And Marcus, a teenager at the time, I think was scared, and for several reasons. And, you know, he looked at that and thought, I don't want to end up like this guy. And that I think it really shook him. Like, the historians say that it shook him. And sometimes they exaggerate. There's propaganda, rhetoric, you know, that leads them to say he didn't really want to be emperor. We had to kind of drag him into it. But I think in Marcus's case, that's true. Like, he thought the last emperor was a complete car crash and I don't want to end up like him. And then, you know, Marcus saw Antoninus Pius and he thought, this guy's the opposite. Like, so he went from this terrible, like, negative role model, like, that can really frighten him off, to seeing someone doing the opposite and being everything that Hadrian wasn't. And by the way, Marcus says several times that no one could say of Antoninus that he was a sophist, which is interesting. Whereas actually, you know, talking of the sophists, Hadrian definitely wanted to be a sophist. Like, you know, he kind of competed with them, like, and wanted to be famous for his rhetorical skill.
It is really interesting because we know for a fact that Hadrian was an enormous influence on Marcus. They have a multi-year relationship. He picks him out as a kid, as you titled your new graphic novel. He gives him this nickname. So they're clearly an affection and a bond. And Hadrian selects him, grooms him for power. And yet he appears almost nowhere in Meditations.
Yeah.
There's like one or two sort of offhanded mentions. And it's really about how no one will remember anyone from Hadrian's court. And so what I could make up about that is he had a love and an affection for Hadrian, but very much saw him as who he didn't want to be. And so his treatment of Antoninus is of Hadrian is sort of a, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And so it's this a judgment by omission. That he very much learned who to be from Antoninus and who not to be from Hadrian, which is unusual because most of the hereditary kings would have only seen like their parent ruling. Marcus has the unusual experience of seeing two predecessors do their job before he comes along.
Yeah, and he was adopted by Hadrian. Was technically his adoptive grandfather. But I'd go even a little tiny bit further, and I'd say that I think in the ancient world, and certainly in Latin literature, like the educated Romans were much more attuned to rhetoric than most of us are today.
Sure.
And they knew that if you heap praise on somebody, often, implicitly, what you're doing, without even mentioning their name, is trashing somebody else. So in particular, if you say the new emperor is so intelligent and so merciful, that implies that the last emperor was stupid and cruel, right? And they totally heard that. So when Marcus heaps praise on Antoninus Pius and says nothing, which was would be a profound insult, would be very serious, like in Rome, to completely like blank, you know, Hadrian. People would read that and think, of course, the stuff he says about Antoninus Pius is implicitly a criticism. And some of it really stands out. Like that line about no one could ever call Antoninus a sophist really sounds like it's an implicit criticism of Hadrian, as do some of the other things that he says. And you're right, he does mention Hadrian, I think, two or three other times, but it's only to use him as an example of somebody who used to be a big deal and is now pushing up daisies. Being leveled by death.
Well, you meet people who are very successful, or they have maybe what you think you want, and or maybe you just see them on TV, or maybe you're just reading about them in a Shakespeare play or whatever, and you go, oh, that's not success at all. I don't want to be this person. I think, is it Posidonius or Panatinus that sees Marius at the end of his life and realizes like, this might have been the most successful general and consul that Rome has ever known, but this guy is a complete slave to power and ego. And he really paints this sort of pathetic picture of a great man. And I think Marcus had a unique understanding of what a great emperor was, and then whatever he didn't think a great emperor was, which was more Hadrian. But then there is this kind of conflict of interest there, because Hadrian was so good to Marcus and had set Marcus. So I think he just saw his adopted grandfather as this kind of tragic figure who he very much did not want to end up like.
Yeah, but Ryan, the last teenage boy that Hadrian heaped favors on and was really, really good to wound up.
That's true.
Found drowned at the bottom of the Nile. Like, that was Antoninus. Like, and he was about the same age that Marcus, when Hadrian first discovered him, that Marcus was, like, when Hadrian came back from his travels and he was, they grew closer. So I think Marcus, so we know there were many, many busts of Antoninus of course, all around Hadrian's Villa. Marcus is brought there. He sees all these busts of this other teenage kid that was Hadrian. Imagine how weird that would have been.
Sure.
Think, be surrounded by loads of images of this crazy despotic ruler's dead ex-teenage boyfriend, and now he's decided he wants you to move in. Like, I think part of that also, that must have made Marcus feel, to say the least, extremely awkward and self-conscious. And he must have thought, am I going to end up drowned at the bottom of the Nile or something if I say something or do something that upsets Hadrian? Like, you know, it's Hadrian turned Antoninus into a god. He deified him and built this huge cult around him. So Hadrian's praising you isn't necessarily a good thing. It could be quite scary sometimes.
There's strings attached to the favor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Zeno famously said that well-being is realized by small steps, but it's no small thing. And I think mental health is a journey like that. Little decisions you make, little interventions, little things that you learn help get you to a place where you're happier, you're more resilient. And for me, a small but cumulatively big part of that journey has been therapists. I've had all sorts of therapists in my life. I've done all the different things you can do, and I've learned something from each one of those. And that's why I not only don't think Stoicism is in conflict with therapy, I think they're eminently compatible and complementary. And that's where today's sponsor comes in, Talkspace for Therapy. You can sign up online. Talkspace can get you in right away, and it's a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. Instead of waiting for an appointment, you send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, and they'll engage with you daily, 5 days a week. Talkspace is secure and private and uses the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store your information and comply with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you can get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code STOIC to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's STOIC at Talkspace.com. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit, FIT/dailystoic, and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It is weird. I haven't seen that much speculation, considering it'd be kind of such an obvious insinuation. There isn't that much speculation about a relationship between Marcus Aurelius and Hadrian.
Yeah, there's nothing about that as far as I'm aware, but loads, obviously, with Antoninus. But then Marcus is the other kid that Hadrian's been, you know, like, we're told that there's this weird phrase that kind of bugs me a bit in the Historia Augusta that says Marcus was brought up. The term it uses in Latin literally means in the bosom of Hadrian. Like, he was reared in the bosom of Hadrian, or sometimes it translated in Hadrian's lap, which obviously sounds kind of creepy, right? Yeah. Like, and it must have been, although this isn't really emphasized in the histories, they kind of go from emphasizing how Hadrian was this, like, you know, predatory, older, my pederast, basically, to then kind of dropping that when it comes to talking about Marcus.
Yeah, although, why do you think that is?
I don't know. Maybe they just didn't want to tarnish Marcus's name in any way by any kind of sexual innuendo. But they made a lot. There was a lot of sexual innuendo about Hadrian and other teenage boys, not just Antinous. You know, so obviously, you know, Marcus is in a in an awkward environment there. And then he says in the meditations, again, really cryptically, something about Antoninus Pius doing away with pederasty. And he kind of praises him for that. And he praises Antoninus for bringing an end to pederasty. It's not really clear what he means by that. But again, it does sound a bit like a contrast with Hadrian. You definitely couldn't have said that of Hadrian.
Sure.
You know, it sounds like some kind of implicit contrast that he might be making there again.
I find Marcus Aurelius and Antoninus' relationship so fascinating because, okay, so for people who don't understand or don't know this, Hadrian sees something in Marcus, believes he can be emperor, but Marcus is only 16 or 17 years old at the time, right? So it's too early. Hadrian understands power intimately enough to know that's how you make a Nero, right? You do not give a 17-year-old boy unlimited power. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be not even a regent, but there needs to be someone else to groom Marcus for success. And so he picks Antoninus. Maybe he thinks Antoninus will live for 10 more years or 5 years, and he lives for almost 20. But this weird, chain of succession that Hadrian sets up, Antoninus, as soon as he becomes emperor, could have done whatever he wanted, right? Mm-hmm. And that Antoninus goes, even though Antoninus had actually earned the job. Antoninus is the most successful Roman politician at that time, is powerful, is well-respected, has built this reputation. You know, he earned it. And then he's being told, you're a placeholder for this kid.
Yeah.
In every other historical instance of anything like that, very quickly after.
Yeah, you're right. It's very weird. And actually, I've thought about this a lot, because I've written three books about Marcus in a row now. I wrote a prose biography of Marcus for Yale University Press, but I had to really dig in to the details a lot more. But I still can't really understand exactly what was going on with the succession plans. I mean, it may be that they were just a little bit chaotic. Because Hadrian, first of all, picks Lucius Aelius, who's Lucius Verus's father.
Right.
And then everybody thought he was a terrible choice because he had no accomplishments to his name. And he died prematurely. He was a very sickly man. And then Antoninus has nothing in common with this dude. So there's no real logic to it. The only thing I can think is maybe that Hadrian's succession plans were in such a mess at this point, and he was becoming sort of ill and paranoid and withdrawn and stuff, that possibly the Senate kind of pressured him into choosing Antoninus. So they maybe thought, okay, you chose this other crazy guy. There's just one of your entourage or another kind of hanger on, that's a nobody. And that ended really badly. So will you please just let us now have the guy that we want? It kind of feels a little bit like that to me, because he seems to have gone from, to picked a completely different type of character in Antoninus. And it was a good choice, surprisingly good choice. But I'll tell you another bit.
Go ahead.
I was going to say another little bit of trivia, just kind of harking back to that thing about being brought up in the bosom of Hadrian. Something I didn't fully realize until I kind of started to write more and more about this is Hadrian had, some of the Roman emperors had a network of spies that they used quite extensively. And they also had this practice of paying informers, that seems quite central to a lot of what happened. Hadrian used that pretty extensively. We're told about it a number of times. You know, he'd open people's letters, he'd have spies put in people's households. And of course, all these people that he thought were conspiring to seize the throne from him, you can bet that he was opening the mail and had spies in their households. So the freedmen and the slaves in their households are really easy to recruit as informers. These are people who have very little. If you say, listen, if you tell me everything that you hear, then I'll set you free and I'll give you a lot of money. you know, from the emperor. That's extremely persuasive. So I think, imagine knowing that and then being told you have to move into Hadrian's villa, where everybody around you works for him.
Sure.
And so anything you say, is potentially going to, is going to be reported back to Hadrian. So I think Marcus must have thought, I have to be extremely careful what I say out loud and who I confide in. Even when he was in his mother's house, but certainly once he moved into Hadrian's house. And then supposedly Antoninus and Marcus did away with that. So that was, I think, it's not spoken about much, but one of the other big changes, big transitions would be that they stopped spying on people, allegedly.
Well, and I think that's probably also a credit then to Antoninus and Marcus Aurelius that they managed to pass the test, given all the spying and informants that were going on. And isn't there a story that one of the reasons that Hadrian picks Antoninus is that he sees Antoninus helping his elderly father-in-law up a set of stairs? That there is this sort of inherent goodness in Antoninus that was relatively rare at that time, or is rare in politics even to this day. And perhaps that goes to, whatever that goodness that he sees in Marcus that gets him to nickname him Verissimus, and then the goodness that he sees in Antoninus, exception that proves the rule, it works out with both of them. They were both inherently good and decent people, despite a lot of temptations and a lot of reasons not to be.
I think so. In fact, I think we can go a bit further. So incidentally, there's another passage in the Meditations that once you know this stuff about history, again, often these little bits of history suddenly give added meaning to some things that Marcus says. So one of them is, then you notice, he says, never say or do anything that requires walls or curtains, he says in the Meditations. You think, of course, because literally you couldn't. You had to assume that, everything that you did was in public view and was being reported back to the emperor. So that must have had a special meaning for him. But, the other thing that strikes me is we don't know why Hadrian calls Marcus Verissimus. It's a really weird omission. So this is kind of emphasized in the histories, and it's obviously quite important. It's in Cassius Dio, it's in the Historia Augusta, but also we know that this seems to have been public knowledge because Justin Martyr, in his apology, addresses Marcus as Verissimus the philosopher in adulthood, right? So everyone knew, even in a kind of semi-official letter, he's using this title. So it must have become a sort of cognomen. And he also, it's interesting, he seems to associate it with him being a philosopher, which makes it even more intriguing. So what was it that earned him this title? There's a story there that's kind of missing. And it's kind of annoying because it obviously sounds like another really famous story, which is the context that we're told that is it follows on from being told that Hadrian persecuted sophists and other intellectuals that disagreed with him. So he would exile them or destroy their careers. And there's a famous sophist called Favorinus of Aralata who supposedly joked that Hadrian had used a word incorrectly and the sophists were kind of obsessed with how to use individual words correctly and stuff, etymology and stuff like that. So he'd used a word incorrectly. And Favorinus's followers said, how come you didn't just tell him that you got that wrong? And Favorinus said, you can forgive me for not wanting to point out the errors of a man that commands 30 legions. In other words, he's an intellectual coward, right? He's a victim of scale.
To power is a risky proposition.
It's like Hans Christian Andersen's fable of the emperor's new clothes, right? So everyone's scared to tell this guy that he's walking about naked, he's using words wrong and stuff like that, except that then there's this little kid. Actually, we don't know how old he was, but my best guess is it's kind of implied that it was before he reached six, in the Historia Augusta, I think, from the context. So it's kind of implied that he did this when he was small. It sounds like Marcus said or did something that maybe everyone else at court was, and it we don't know, but all the kind of circumstantial clues sort of indicate it's like the emperor's new clothes. And everyone was like, wow, that kid is the only person that could tell Hadrian something he didn't want to hear. And then, maybe weirdly, this guy that was spying on everybody, and persecuting anyone that would speak out against him, took a shine to Marcus because he thought, this kid is the only one that's got the nerve to tell me when I've made a mistake or something like that, perhaps. Right. I knew what it was that he said to him.
No, that's lovely. And in Meditations, he does, you know, he says, like, if it's not true, don't say it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not true, don't think it. He did seem to put a lot of emphasis on just speaking the truth, doing the right thing, even if it made you unpopular, even if it was risky. And maybe that's a lifelong habit.
This is a bit of trivia as well, but Herodian says that Marcus had another son called Marcus Annius Verus. So he named this other son after himself. That was Marcus's birth name that ran in his family. And he appointed him Caesar alongside Commodus. He was like a year or two younger than Commodus. But this kid died when he was about 5 years old. And Herodian says that Marcus also nicknamed this kid Verissimus. Mm. Like, so he handed down the nickname. And he gave it to what seems like possibly his favorite son. Maybe this kid, even though he only lived to be about five, perhaps also said something very blunt and frank and honest. And Marcus looked at him and thought, he's got, you know, this frankness, the parrhesia, like of the freedom of speech of the philosophers cherished so much. Perhaps
it is remarkable, like when you think, you go, oh, how hard it would be to be a Stoic when you're an emperor, right? And it would be. But you think about, you just describe a situation where a person loses six children before adulthood, and you try not just to think, was that person able to be Stoic, but like, could that person get out of bed in the morning, right? Like that is like a horror story of horror stories. It's as close to incomprehensible as I have found in the study of people. Like there's always things you're like, wow, that's hard to wrap my head around. But the idea that Marcus loses not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, but six children, it's impossible to even conceive what that, even when people say things like, oh, that was much more common back then. I mean, it wasn't common like that.
It's like, I'd say yes and no to people who say it's certainly true that infant mortality was common, death in childhood was common, and some people were kind of numb to it. But there's also examples of people being absolutely distraught. Actually, Fronto, in one of his letters to Marcus, talks about how he lost a grandson that was very small, and he's virtually suicidal. He's completely beside himself over the loss of his grandson. So it's certainly not true. And also, sometimes people think that Roman nobles could be quite... See, we tend to make generalizations about figures in history, right? So it's true that a lot of Roman fathers had little contact with their children until they reached like adulthood, about 50 years old in Roman society. However, Marcus in his letters shows that he was a real family man, and it sounds like he spent a lot of time with his young children. Like, he talks to Fronto about them. He seems to take real joy in watching them play and things like that. So that, you know, even if other Romans were like that, Marcus wasn't like that. And he's an incredibly affectionate and warm individual in his letters to his friends as well. So he certainly would have been devastated. We're told that he was absolutely devastated when he lost one of his tutors.
Yeah, right.
Of his teachers. So, of course, he would have been devastated at the loss of his children. And, you know, something else you said was that it was kind of like a horror show. When I was working on the graphic novel, one of the things that kind of emerged for me when we kind of put it on the page and we tried to visualize Marcus's life, it dawned on me one day that I thought, this is a horror story. I didn't realize. It didn't dawn on me until we were trying to visualize it, and I thought, This is like we're writing a horror story in places. The warfare, the carnage, the Antonine plague. What happens in prose history is that you'll say there was a plague, and then there was a war, and then there was another war, and then there was like a civil war.
They were all happening at the same time.
It happened at the same time. Yeah. The plague is ongoing, like for the rest of his life.
Right.
People were going blind with sores on their faces, and you know, like horrible outbreaks and stuff, devastating. It was very visible as well. Like, so Marcus's life, I think from that point onwards, from the point of the plague onwards, became, I think Rome must have become, and all the indications in the histories are that Rome became a darker and kind of more desperate place. We're told, incidentally, about religious fanatics appearing and exploiting the gullible during the plague and stuff like that happening. There was a civil war, like, during the plague. Like, so there was, I think, social unrest and a kind of breakdown of the cohesion of society to some extent. It was tense. Things got kind of tense.
Yeah, I wonder what that's like, a plague, civil unrest. If only there was some way we could relate to that experience. Well, you know, your point about how the more you understand about Marcus's life, and this is what I was trying to do in Lives of the Stoics. I think you do this well in the graphic novel. You do it extremely well in how to think like a Roman emperor, is that when you understand the history, you realize a lot of these, as you said, a lot of these lines and meditations, you understand that it's not just this throwaway observation. There's a life experience behind it. So there's one part, and I talked to Robin Waterfield about this. There, I forget which book it is. It's later in Meditations, but there's like two back-to-back entries where Marcus is clearly talking about having, he talks about, you know, wanting children in old age. You reach for your children and they're not there anymore. You know, he talks about basically what it's like to care about someone and lose someone and then they're gone. This isn't just some abstract philosophical observation. He could be talking about the son that was named after him or his favorite daughter, or like, these are real things that he's talking about that would have been excruciatingly painful and tragic and awful that really happened to him as a human being.
Let's talk about that, the style of the meditations a little bit, because that's something that really intrigues me. Like, I know one of the first things I noticed about the meditations is there's a couple of strange things about the way that it's written. So it's artfully vague in a sense. There are places where he mentions names of individuals, particularly in book one, but elsewhere. Sometimes he'll name people and we've no idea who he's talking about, like figures that are forgotten in history. And he'll mention some specific events, but generally it's really vague. So, like, probably one of the most famous passages in the Meditations is the right at the start of book two, where he says, every morning when you wake up, tell yourself you're going to meet troublesome, treacherous, and meddling people and blah, blah, blah. Who are these people? Like, you know, it's odd in a way that he doesn't give any kind of indication throughout. Sure. I think there's a kind of technical reason why he does that. And it's also really cool how we know about it. So scholars, when they discovered in the 19th century, we also have this cache of letters from Fronto to Marcus, and also between Fronto and a few other people that they knew. And Fronto was Marcus's Latin rhetoric tutor, right? So scholars were a bit disappointed because Fronto was meant to be second only to Cicero, the greatest orator in Roman history. And they thought, well, in these letters, he doesn't really seem that impressive. And there's not that much philosophy. There's very little philosophy, really, in them. He's mainly kind of talking about family, complaining about his gout, and talking about sleep a lot, being sick. Yeah, and there, like, Marcus's homework that he was kind of setting him as well. Like, you know, you've got to write an essay about such and such. But there's a really cool thing. Like, at one point, there's this kind of battle between Marcus being taught Stoic philosophy and being taught rhetoric between the Stoics and the Sophists, and whether Junius Rusticus or Marcus Cornelius Fronto is going to be his main tutor. It seems like there's kind of like a tension, a conflict there. There obviously is. And so Fronto will repeatedly try and persuade Marcus that he needs to study rhetoric, even if he wants to be a philosopher. And he says at one point, I think he returns this a couple of times actually, that philosophers tend to come up with paradoxes. Like, so because they're thinking really deeply, they'll say things that have never been said before. Yeah. Like, they're struggling to find the words. And he says, so of course, these ideas that they have are kind of obscure, and you need rhetoric to be able to articulate them clearly for your own benefit and other people's. And he says to Marcus, as a homework assignment, what you should do is take these sayings and turn them over repeatedly in your mind and paraphrase them, like say them several different ways. Now, scholars immediately went, well, hang on a minute. That kind of looks like what the Meditations is. Like, he's taken these wisdom, say, you know, because it's quite repetitive, right? Why is he saying the same thing over and over again in different words? Like, because he's been saying this as an intellectual exercise, like decades earlier by Fronto. But it may also explain why it seems weirdly abstract, because I guess if you took a philosophical insight about a specific situation, and then you think, I'm going to keep paraphrasing that and trying to find different words, I think it starts to lose its specificity, if you know what I mean, right?
Sure. Like, no, and that's actually Epictetus's advice, which I have on the back of the journal. He says, every day and night, keep thoughts like these at hand, write them, read them aloud, talk to yourself and others about them. That's what the philosophy is. It's like Meditations is the byproduct of the philosophy, as opposed to the articulation of the philosophy. It'd be like if you could somehow see a transcript of a Zen Buddhist meditation practice, that's what you'd be seeing. But actually, the transcript is irrelevant. It was the doing it that was important.
So because it's kind of, he leaves it sort of abstract, and maybe because he's saying the same things over and over again, it becomes a little bit more vague. The names kind of drop, specific names drop out and stuff. I think that's partly why the Meditations became so popular, because when he says, imagine every morning that you're going to meet troublesome people and meddling people and so on, we think that sounds like that guy that works at the desk across from me.
Yeah.
Or that sounds like my mother-in-law, or that sounds like one of my friends, right? So we project ourselves. He leaves us enough space to project ourselves into his shoes. So the positive side of that is it's easy for people to see themselves in the words and to adapt them to their own modern situation. The downside of it, I think, is that it does at times become a little bit abstract. And if you start to combine it with history and imagine that he's talking about real people and real situations, I think in some ways that allows us to picture, to put more of a human face on Stoic philosophy and see what Marcus is saying is more of a kind of livable philosophy of life. So there's pros and cons, I think, to the abstract way that he tends to articulate himself in the Meditations.
The example of that hit me the hardest, and we might have talked about this when we talked, I guess this would have been in 2020, but there's a line in Meditations where Marcus Aurelius talks about how there's two types of plagues. There's the one that can destroy your life and the one that can destroy your character, right?
Yeah.
When I read that in 2007, you know, it was very different than when I reread it for however many of the time in March of 2020. You go, oh, I see what you're talking about now, because now I've experienced a plague and I've seen what a plague does to people's character. And you realize Marcus is talking about the kinds of things that you're seeing around you all the time, and the way that external events and stresses can reveal what's fundamentally flawed or vulnerable in a person.
I would put the timescale slightly differently. Actually, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, when people talked about that quote, they thought it seems a bit harsh. Like, it seems he's being a little bit dismissive of the plague. But then as our pandemic went on, I think more people are like, no, he's got a point. Like, you know, the pandemic was bad, but like the impact on society, like psychologically, politically is even worse, in some ways. So I can see where he's coming from for sure. But that's also strangely abstract as well, isn't it? It's the only time that he really explicitly mentions the plague, and what he says about it is strangely kind of philosophical, I suppose. It's abstract, you know.
It's like 20, that occupies 20 years of his life, or whatever, 15 years of his life. And it gets the only mention is that it can affect some people's character negatively. That seems like a weird summary of a momentously historical, and not just historical, but to him, it would have been a day-to-day event, right? In the way that he would have woken up every day and news of the plague or things inspired by or changed by the plague would have been shaping what he was doing. And that's the only instance of it.
on a huge, yeah. Like, I mean, it shifted the fate of the war really explicitly. I mean, to the extent that I think the Praetorian Guard had an outbreak of the plague, and so kind of like his personal bodyguard or personal legion almost. And they lost one of the Praetorian Guards at that time. And a lot of historians think it's possible that he was taken by the plague as well. So he would have been a friend of Marcus. Like, he would have been one of his closest associates and as one of his most senior generals. So, like, you not only is he seeing this everywhere, but it's causing total chaos in terms of the hierarchy of Roman society. Now he's got to find people to fill these roles, and now he's got to figure out, you know, how to fight battles when some of these legions are, you know, dying of the plague. It could also be, you know, the uprising in Egypt that where these tribesmen called the Bucolae were able to defeat the Egyptian legion. And then Avidius Cassius, Marcus's most senior general in the East, had to be sent and given emergency powers to put down this uprising. That may be because the Egyptian legion had the plague at the time, perhaps. And they may have been under strength. And therefore, the Bucolae might have thought, this is our opportunity. You guys are all dying of the plague in there. And they saw a chance and took it. It seems like it's not a coincidence that the Romans had all these uprisings and the big Marcomanni invasion at that time.
They were weakened.
They were seriously weakened, yeah.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
I had something else I wanted to run by you because I've been thinking about it a lot recently. I was reading Hierocles or Heracles. How do you pronounce it?
I think it's Hierocles.
Okay. I was reading Hierocles, and the translator was making this note that when the Stoics started, they started with a kind of, they were very much descended from the Cynics, right? There's this sort of rejection of, earthly things. There was kind of this, it's hyper individualistic, you know, like get what's your, you know, focus on your own self improvement, forget everything else. And that as Stoicism evolves, she's sort of noting that it softens, right? Yeah. That it softens into the notion of justice. Even though Zeno talks about courage, temperance, justice, wisdom, She's saying that the justice was undervalued as a virtue. But by the time it gets to Marcus Aurelius, this idea of being community minded, of participating, of trying, of giving a shit about other people, this becomes the primary Stoic virtue, which Marcus Aurelius says, you know, a number of times in Meditations. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that evolution? What do you think about that evolution? Then I have another follow-up to that.
I think it's true. Maybe in some ways they just conceptualized justice and social responsibility a little bit differently in classical Greece than they did in Roman society. But for sure, the Cynics were less concerned with our social bonds and responsibility, and they do seem a bit harsh at times. And the Stoics, Marcus Aurelius puts so much emphasis on justice. He actually literally says at one point that it's the most important virtue. He mentions justice or natural affection or cosmopolitanism or something along those lines, that something that has to do with our interpersonal relationships and our relationship with society in almost every page of the Meditations. Like, it's the main theme, really, of the book. That's not so much. And obviously, in Diogenes the Cynic, if he is concerned about society, it's in a more rudimentary way.
Yeah, and I've just been interested in that evolution now because it does seem that there is a hyper-individualistic, I don't want to say right wing because it puts too much of a modern political lens, but there does seem to be a misunderstanding today of Stoicism that skips out on the inconvenience of having to care about other people. And perhaps the confusion is, in the dichotomy of control, we don't really control other people. So maybe people are confused as to why they're supposed to care about their well-being. But Marcus Aurelius doesn't seem to have any confusion in this regard.
I think so. I mean, I think it's also linguistically, because we use the word Stoic. Like, all of these terms for Greek philosophy, their meanings became caricatured over the centuries, right?
Sure.
So what we mean by Epicurean today, generally is just somebody that enjoys, you know, fancy food and fine dining and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And what we mean by cynic with a small c is just somebody that kind of sneers at things and,
sure,
you know, has a negative attitude towards other people. And sophist, skeptic, like these other words, academic, have all kind of become a little bit simplified or caricatured in their meaning over time. So Stoic comes to mean just being like a robot, or, you know, being unemotional. And that's actually how we use the term in psychology as a research construct. In research on lowercase stoicism consistently shows that it's problematic, it's toxic, it leads to increased psychological or emotional vulnerability. We often have to explain to psychologists that what we mean by Stoic philosophy is much more nuanced and complex, like, than just kind of suppressing your feelings.
It's like when people hear the word sexy, it doesn't have anything to do with sex anymore. It means beautiful or attractive or well-designed or sleek or awesome. You know, when you hear Stoic, 99% of the time, it's not remotely connected to Stoic philosophy.
And that confuse, like, even people that, weirdly, even people that read Marcus Aurelius or other books in Stoicism still kind of are viewing it through that lens in many cases. And so I've met people who read the Meditations, and I talk to them about this, and they say that they hadn't even noticed that Marcus is talking about justice and society,
yes,
and natural affection. And I think, how is it possible? Like, it's kind of the main, he goes on and on and on about it. It reminds me of this quote from William Blake that says, we both read the Bible day and night, but you read black where I read white. I kind of think, how could you have not noticed all of the references, you know, to not being alienated from your fellow man and, you know, having love? At one point at the beginning, Marcus says that he's describing the ideal Stoic. He's talking about Sextus of Chaeronea, like Plutarch's nephew, who was one of his Stoic teachers. And he describes him as being free from passions. And he mentions anger, like, so free from passions such as anger, and yet full of phlegethorgia, full of love.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite passages.
Full of love, kind of brotherly love he's talking about. Philostorgia, basically, is what we translate as natural affection, but it means the love of a parent for the children. It's kind of like paternal love, or we might say platonic love, brotherly love. He thinks that's the pinnacle of Stoicism. And then, you know, and yet people have this kind of atomistic, individualistic view of it that's just about, it's almost more like nihilism, the way that people interpret Stoicism in many cases. And I really think if Marcus Aurelius was around, he would think this is more or less the opposite of what I thought the human ideal was. You guys are completely alienated, like, from other people around you and the rest of society. And Stoics want to reverse that. They want this, but in a sense, I think Stoic virtue, particularly in Zeno and in the early Greek Stoics, it's tied up with their pantheism. And I think one of their starting points is this idea that they want us to be more of one with the rest of the universe. Yeah. They want us to realize our oneness with the cosmos as a whole, and with our fellow men, like with other human beings. It's extraordinary, by the way, just as a slight aside to that, Marcus mentions Rome being a Roman citizen a couple of times in the Meditations. But other than that, when he talks about overcoming anger, feeling love, overcoming alienation, he's talking about people in general, not just Roman subjects or citizens. And the people that he's dealing with as he's writing that are often what the Romans would have called barbarian envoys. Like, you know, it's strange to think that, we lose sight of that unless we imagine him writing the Meditations in the evening after he's had a meeting with a bunch of foreign envoys in the morning. And also he'd been surrounded by foreigners. All the auxiliary units would have been Germanic tribesmen and people from other parts of the empire.
Well, so, he's not just talking about his fellow well-educated, rich Roman senators who went to the same schools and had the same he's not talking about our brotherly connection as he spent time with a couple hundred people exactly like him in a beautiful marble palace. It's in the mud of a quincum, right? Like it's far away, and he's surrounded by salt of the earth, regular ass people.
He says at one point, actually in Meditations 2.1, he says, I'm not talking about a bond of seed, i.e. like family, or blood, i.e. race. He specifically says, like, and it's odd that he would say that, because it really highlights the fact that he's talking about brotherly love towards the people he's at war with.
Yeah.
Which is, I think becomes highlighted more if we really try and visualize the historical context in which he's writing this. If we are to believe Lucian, the chronology of this, annoyingly, is there's some debate among scholars, but one interpretation is that 20,000 Roman soldiers were killed in a single day at the beginning of the Marcomannic War at Carnuntum, where Marcus then stations himself, right? That would have been one of the biggest defeats in Roman military history. And then Marcus goes there and stations, which must have, you know, been incredibly risky. Like, so knowing that he's in this place where loads of Romans have been slaughtered by the Germanic tribesmen, he's telling himself, nevertheless, I have to view these people as my brothers and sisters.
Yeah, it's he's being tested at the realist level, because the preservation of the empire is at stake, public opinion is at stake, he's just witnessed a horrible atrocity, and he's trying to go back to his philosophical first principles and go, not what do I emotionally think in this moment, not what is politically convenient to think in this moment, not what will rile the troops up in this moment, but like, what at my bedrock values as a human being do I want to believe in this moment?
And that really reminds me of something that I wanted to mention, actually. And we kind of came close to earlier when we were talking about how often he'd been bereaved and lost all of those children, but also many other friends and family members that he'd lost. It only, as I was working on the graphic novel and again, like trying to really visualize Marcus's life, did it really dawn on me. I just I remember just kind of sitting up one day and thinking, it really hit me for the first time suddenly that Marcus Aurelius, during the plague, surrounded by people who at one point increasingly were probably plotting to assassinate him, also many people assumed that Marcus Aurelius was going to die because he looked very frail.
Yeah.
Stationing himself at the frontier where he was risking his life, all of these things combined, when I really just started to picture it, I suddenly realized he really must have woken up each morning and kind of pinched himself and thought, am I actually still alive?
He was living on borrowed time.
He really must have felt that, and even beyond the, like, the all, like, I get the impression that all these people around him were gossiping about, they thought he's not going to last much longer. And he had that going on for at least a decade, I think. Like, people speculating about his impending death. What must it be like to kind of know that that's the gossip and that some people in the wings are just waiting for you to die? Like, he's constant, like, his sense of his own mortality, I really think must have been much more pervasive and intense than it would be for most of us. You know,
well, that was my favorite. That was my favorite passage in your book, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. You talked about how one of the rudimentary attempts to ward off the plague was they would burn incense, right? Yeah. Which was also masking the horrendous stench of dead bodies. Yeah. And how Marcus would have woken up every day and smelled that. All the Romans would. It would have been literally in the air, just in the way that the virus is in the air. So yeah. Too is the reality of your looming inevitable death.
And even, we can't be 100% for sure, because actually one of the curiosities about Galen's account is he doesn't mention, from what I remember, pock marks or scarring on the skin. I could be wrong about that. That's my recollection. That seems a little bit odd. But if it was smallpox, which is believed is probably a variant of smallpox, then, you know, we would expect people to have had pock marks on their faces. So, for the next 15 years or so, Marcus would have been surrounded in people's faces. Stars. And some people would also have lost their vision. You know, they would get kind of cataracts from the effect that the plague would spread onto the surface of their eyes. They would maybe even have lost fingers or be crippled by it. So they would be very visible, potentially. And you say the incense hanging there would have been a constant reminder as well.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up, because Memento Mori is, I think, the most beautiful, life-changing, and probably perennial theme in meditation. Just over and over again, he's reminding himself, life is very short. He says, you could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think. And if Marcus Aurelius needed to remind himself of that in the midst of the Antonine Plague, when you really could drop dead like that, the idea that we wouldn't need to in our much softer, more protected bubble of a world, we need that reminder much more so.
And I think in the meditations, we're benefiting from the fact that Marcus Aurelius faced so much danger.
Yes.
Like, so we get his wisdom is very deep in this regard, because he spent decades really, you know, very immediately contemplating his own mortality. And then we get to read about what he made of that philosophically.
Beautiful. Well, I love the books and I always love talking to you, and I hope to see you again one of these days.
Yeah, likewise. It's been a pleasure as always, Ryan. Thanks very much.
Being able to control your anger is a difficult but worthwhile goal. It will take time and effort. It won't be free. But by changing your perspective and developing techniques to control your temper, it will ultimately be achievable and life-changing. So take the first step on the path to a calmer and more fulfilling future. Check out Taming Your Temper, the 10-day Stoic Guide to Controlling Your Anger. You can just go to dailystoic.com/anger.
Hey,
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.